Okay, welcome to another episode of the Pain Podcast. And I am the host today, Tim Beams, and I've got the great pleasure of introducing Alison Sim, who is joining us from Melbourne. So we're at other ends of the day, aren't we, at the moment?
We are. A huge
thanks for joining me, and we're gonna I'll introduce you in 2 seconds, but we're gonna delve into your PhD and how that applies to clinical work as well. But just a little heads up, you originally qualified as an osteopath. I think you're the first osteopath that we've spoken to. I think so. So brilliant to have an osteopath. Although I wonder whether that's how you identify now, or and then you did a master's in pain, and you've been an author. You wrote a lovely book. It's about stories of recovery and hope, isn't it?
That's right.
Pain heroes.
That's right.
Stories of hope and recovery, which is great. I love that. How many people who experience pain want to hear that things can be, there's hope for them?
Yeah, so, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. And now crazy person, but now you're doing a PhD and you're keeping up with your clinical work, family life, etc., etc. So maybe we can ask how that's going as well. So
Brilliant. Thanks for having me, Tim. It's lovely to see your face and have a chat.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's been a long time. So, could you do your best? And maybe this is good practice, isn't it? How would you describe what you're looking at with your PhD at the moment?
It's a good question. And in my final year, I'm hoping to submit towards the end of the year. And I think you should have your spiel down by this stage. I'm still probably not quite there. I am interested in looking at early interventions to prevent the development of chronic pain following injury, and particularly interested in injury in the setting of compensable care, so under workers' compensation or motor vehicle accident insurance schemes. So that's where I've focused my PhD.
So I'm hearing, or I'm thinking, this has huge value for the type. So for me as a clinician, I have to say I don't work so much nowadays, but I certainly did a lot. I saw a lot of people who were in accidents and they had an ongoing claim at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is what you're finding, but the process of the claim was unbelievably stressful sometimes. And in fact, could impact a lot of both the care, but also their life.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been the crux of both the drive to get into this space as a clinician, but also it's been where the research has gone to. And exactly as you said there, Tim, that the distress of actually interacting with the processes that are required to, engage with that claim are actually a really big predictor of poor outcomes. So, you know, people who have that stressful claim tend to have poorer outcomes, and that's been well documented in the literature. But it's also what we found in our qualitative research is that as a source of distress, it almost comes up as number one. And then, you know, when we look at the data that compares people who have a claim and an injury versus people who don't have a claim and an injury, they, you know, without the presence of the claim, people just tend to do better. So it's, as you say, it's really clinically relevant stuff, and most people who are working with patients who have a compensation claim will be nodding along because it's certainly something that's very familiar to them.
I have someone in mind at the moment where they are having to do a lot of the footwork, you know, chasing, am I able to have funding for this? I feel like I need it. And I'm sorry, this is, God, I don't want to overtake this, but I'm just, God, this has such relevance because they are having to be the advocate for themselves. Yeah. And I've had this conversation where I'm like, it's almost like you've had to learn how to navigate healthcare and the claim culture as well in order for you to be able to get the best for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And often what we found in that qualitative research is people would do really well in a system where they don't have to jump through a lot of hoops. They'd be recovering really well. And then they get to a point where they're having to apply for sessions or ongoing care. And if there's a delay that occurs with that, and that, you know, those delays often come about because of a lack of awareness that those processes were required. And therefore, you know, you're often looking at, you know, we were talking to people who'd had up to 6 week delays when things have been going really well for 3 months, they're on a great trajectory. And then they're hitting that period where treatment is interrupted. And that, again, is a massive source of distress. And you can imagine as well from a claimant point of view or a patient point of view, that's where the injustice starts. And we know, again, that that's a massive predictor of poor outcomes. So, you know, in our research to underpin the intervention that we went on to deliver, we really heard very strongly that these sources of distress were often avoidable, but very common.
Yeah. So given that that is the case, who should we be sort of getting this knowledge to then, do you think?
So at its heart, it's a systems problem, and I think everyone is aware that this is about the systems that deliver these things. And they're, you know, the people who deliver these systems are very well intentioned, that they're there to try and provide really good care and to look after the people that their insurance systems cover. But as we know, with big institutions and system problems, that some things do go a bit awry. I guess so. We're looking at where can we have an influence. So if you can't change the entire system, we looked at the things that we could try and change. So perhaps I'll talk a little bit about the intervention that we did end up delivering. So we first of all did this qualitative work with clinicians and claimants. And so we spoke to people who were either receiving care or delivering care, and we spoke to about 30 clinicians who were delivering care within that compensable space. And from that, what we heard was essentially that the experiences of both the claimants and the clinicians about their frustrations with the system overlapped. So describing things like delays to care and, you know, a lack of that social connection, so feeling like no one cared. Those kind of things that both the clinicians and the claimants were reporting the same sorts of things. And that informed us, like even learning about that idea of the delays to treatment and how they came about was really important for us as we then went on to the next phase. So I was then lucky enough to get a grant as part of the TAC is our Transport Accident Commission. That's Victoria's No Fault Motor Vehicle Insurance Scheme. And so our team got a grant to then run a pilot trial for an intervention. So we drew on that research that we'd done in the qualitative work, and then we then went on to do a co-design phase. So we worked with former and current claimants to try and understand what would have helped in the time, what would have made things better, to see if they could help us to generate those answers as to, you know, if we can't fix the whole system, how can we help you? And that was a wonderful process. It gave us the clue that there were three main things that people felt would be helpful. One was they really described that they didn't understand the claims process. And as you sort of say, that they then had to upskill in that area. But the big barrier to that, when you'd sort of say, when you point out that were you aware this information is on the website, and the website for the TAC is very comprehensive and quite easy to navigate, the message that we got back was very strongly that people are overwhelmed and they didn't feel it was their job. And to the point that they almost felt like particularly if they weren't at fault, that this information should be coming to them. There should be an element of passivity to this. It's not their job to be seeking that out, which, you know, without doing that foundational research, that stuff we wouldn't have been aware of. So we heard that about the claims process, that they didn't feel that there was enough information about that. We also interestingly heard about a desire for pain self-management strategies. So this idea that, people were saying things like, you should be warned about opioids before you start taking them, or they should give you other tips and tricks to avoid getting stuck on the medication. That was really interesting. And again, that then drove us to, you know, as we developed that intervention, to put in there some pain self-management strategies. And then the third thing that we really heard strongly was this desire for social support. So again, just that feeling of when someone cares, it really feels nice. And that in that system, it can be quite lonely and it can be quite isolating, and it can leave you with a sense that people don't really care. So people would say things like the phone check-ins were really helpful, or you just wanted that sense that someone was showing that they cared about you. So really that desire for social support was the third thing that we heard. So we then took that and again, under that workshop process with the claimants, we proposed a 5-session telehealth intervention that was delivered by allied health professionals. So we used OTs and physios and a couple of osteopaths to deliver that over telehealth, so that we could reach everyone in Victoria. And so essentially it was delivered over 5 sessions. The first 2 sessions contained standardized videos about the claims process, and to put that together we used the stuff off the website, but we also used some of the things that we'd learned in that qualitative research to prioritise what to put in those videos and why it was important. And then the pain self-management strategies were sort of evidence-informed strategies that our team have previously used in other approaches. And so we had these 2 sort of 7 or 8 minute videos that were delivered in the first and second session. And then our clinicians, we trained them to use their existing skills, but to really use that motivational interviewing approach to identify where there were things that they were finding difficult, and what in the videos had provided answers to that, and then how they might go about, you know, sorting out those issues themselves. So a real emphasis on self-efficacy rather than the clinicians stepping in and saying, well, let me sort that out for you. We delivered that intervention to a small cohort. It was an acceptability and feasibility study, so we delivered it to 11 people, and found that participants were overwhelmingly really pleased with the outcomes of that. So they found that it did meet those needs for helping with the claims information. In some cases, people were describing that it really stopped them from, or they could see that without having that prior knowledge of what to do, that they definitely would have had gaps in their treatment, and that would have been upsetting for them. And we were able to deliver it over telehealth as well. So that was one of the aims, was this feasible to deliver?
Yeah. So if I was had something to do with the funding, then I would be thinking, this sounds like a really, really positive thing to do. So Wow, cool. And then you said about the social support, was that within the within what you delivered?
You've had plenty of people on to describe this before, but the contact with the healthcare provider is really powerful, and I think as clinicians we need to keep that in mind, that by providing validation and support and reassurance, we're getting most of the job done, and that really counts. So, just the high contact, the one-on-one, there were weekly sessions, so that provided the social support.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're beating me to it, but it sounds like you're being a human being, aren't you? You're just being
exactly. Yeah, a consistent friendly listening ear. And yeah. I think the participants did really like the fact that they were health professionals that were delivering it. So they could bounce ideas off about their rehab, or when a clinician was reassuring them about their recovery, that was trustworthy advice. So I think that was really valuable as well, was using experienced clinicians for that.
Yeah. So if by delivering this that felt valuable for people, do you feel that this will have an impact if it was delivered more widely in terms of the possibility of people having recovery or
obviously in a feasibility study we didn't take any health outcomes, so we can't predict what that would have done, but that is our next step. That's what we'd like to do next, is run an RCT. And I think, you know, we're talking about changing systems. To get systems to change, money talks. And so I think we really need to get in there and actually evaluate total claims costs, because that's what's going to make people sit up and pay attention. The other thing that I have always thought is, and this is what sort of, again, as a clinician, made me sitting there with patients and thinking things didn't have to be this bad. And particularly when you've got patients who are angry and they're really looking for justice, and the only avenue open to them is to seek financial compensation in the form of a lump sum. I really feel like if we can take the sting out of the process, less people are likely to, you know, to go looking for that lump sum payment. And I think that's where the money will talk, if we can evaluate that down the track. So that's what interests me. But as you say as well, from a patient point of view, I think hopefully what you'd see is less people developing chronic pain because they're less distressed, better disability outcomes, better engagement with rehabilitation, all of those kind of things that you would hope to see.
Yeah. I've got this, I don't know where this fits in, entirely, but I've just got like a television advert or something, but this phrase, where there's blame there's a claim, sort of running through my head. And I'm thinking, like, given the messages that people will have been bombarded by over the years, I mean, in the UK for instance, I think there's this thing where people go and I think it's called brake check, like they go and they drive and they suddenly brake in front of you as a way to simulate a crash. I don't know whether this is true or not, but like people are out there trying to force this on, but you're bombarded by all these messages. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how helpful that is in terms of the self-efficacy process.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the fact that there is a compensation overlay does change the way people view their recovery. There's no doubt about that. And you know, you're talking about lawyers getting involved. The interesting thing about Australia is we do have state-based systems, and they're all very different. And when researchers go and look at that and try and compare the systems, what they find is where there are more lawyers, there are worse outcomes in terms of function and pain and things like that. So, you know, getting those systems to look after people better so they don't have to seek that is obviously in the best interest of everyone.
Yeah, but I mean, they're not going to want to suddenly leave, are they? So, playing devil's advocate there. So I'm interested in you and the process and what you've learned and things like that as well. So obviously, you at heart are a clinician. This is what you've done over years, and then you've taken your interest of pain into your PhD, which is obviously one way of doing it, isn't it? Is that you've gone there with an interest.
Yes,
have you sort of been surprised in any way from what you found or the process that you've gone through of doing this research?
I think the process for me in doing a PhD has actually been a lot more pleasant than I was expecting. It's been incredibly family friendly. So it's meant that, you know, through the back end of the COVID years, I was able to work from home, and we still managed to get this project up and running. I think you go into it with these big bright ideas and things get chipped down and chipped down. So I think I've definitely learned a lot about the barriers to all sorts of things, including research and implementation, those kind of things. I think one of the really interesting things that I have loved in the research has been some of the implications that came out of the qualitative research that we did with clinicians. I found that really exciting and fascinating, and I really think that clinicians will find it interesting as well. So we interviewed, as I said, about 30 clinicians who deliver care in compensable settings, we started to see a bit of a theme emerge, which is why we kept recruiting when we sort of initially thought we would stop after, you know, between 10 and 15. And we were seeing these really interesting things. And I think it was because we were snowball recruiting. So, you know, one person would refer the next. And once we started getting into the really experienced chronic pain clinicians, we started to see this interesting pattern emerge about this idea of working in complexity. And I know it's a bit of a topic at the moment. I noticed you've been talking about that with Mike Stewart recently. And, you know, there's a lot of researchers talking about complexity and how clinicians engage with that. And when we think about compensable care, or if you're talking about compensable care with clinicians, there is that tendency to have that kind of groan and the thought about it being the heart sink patient and all those kind of things. And that comes with the complexity, right? That's the thing that clinicians think about is if I have to do a full day of that, that is going to be quite full on. There's going to be a lot of talking. There's going to be a lot of emotion. These patients do tend to present a lot more distress. And that's going to affect me as a clinician, how I deal with that. And I guess the assumption that comes with that is that it's draining, it's exhausting, and that people don't like it. And there certainly is an attrition. We wouldn't capture in our data the people that find that really hard and then leave the profession and go and do something that suits them a bit more. But what we found in this cohort of really experienced clinicians was this idea that there's a bit of a pattern to it. So people would realise that they felt out of their depth, that they didn't have the skills to perhaps be able to address the needs of this complex population. Yeah. It prompted them to go and do usually further research. So a lot of people, it was the impetus for them to go and do a master's in pain or further training in another area. We heard a lot about experienced clinicians doing lots of mentoring, lots of further training, particularly around communication and communication skills. And I think essentially what they're learning to deal with in that further training and mentoring is sitting with discomfort and sitting with uncertainty as well, learning to be okay with that. And from there, what these clinicians were describing was this sense of mastery. So getting to a space where they, you know, were essentially feeling like they were a ninja, that they could take on these really complex cases and know that their skills, that they had the skills to meet that complexity and to do a really good job. And with that then came this really strong sense of fulfillment. So this idea that they really get a lot out of their work, and instead of feeling drained and exhausted, that it actually charged them up and felt fantastic. Now that wasn't across the board. It was a bit of an interesting pattern, and you'd often have clinicians in that cohort describing both in the same sentence, feeling exhausted, that the work is exhausting and it's draining, but at the same time it's exhilarating and it's fun and you're kind of dancing in those upper realms of being a ninja clinician.
I mean, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, really, really. Brilliant. Interesting. Yeah. Not what we were expecting.
I love hearing that. Yeah, and it, God, it, on a very selfish level, it feels like it validates what we do as educators as well, doesn't it? So, yeah, wonderful to hear that. So, I mean, God, it sort of fits this idea of, yeah, the relationship between the two, both of you coming to that space in the right place. So reducing the distress for the claimant or the person that's injured and in pain, and but also creating the condition and the environment so that the person treating them is also, I love this, the ninja. Like a ninja. Having a sense of mastery and how we might go about that as well. And the flipping it from, and you, I think back to early career, but I can remember people saying things like, oh, this is a, oh, it's a heart sink patient. And God, if you've said it, imagine what you're going to be like with that person.
Exactly. And so I think having those structures in a clinic, and some of the clinicians that we spoke to, the mentoring sounded amazing. I was ready to pack up and move over and join their clinics. You know, they had sessions where they're all observing each other across the board. They're recording some of their sessions and going through them with mentors to say, you know, perhaps you could have done this a bit better. Being quite scrupulous, which is a really vulnerable place to be. Yes, that, you know, it sounds a little bit terrifying. But obviously the outcomes for those clinicians were really positive. So I think taking away from that, the idea of further education in communication skills is obviously of benefit, but also the mentoring structure seems to be really important.
And in some professions, obviously, that is a bit more, catered for, and others less so. So, that's worth thinking about if you are in a profession where it's not a part of your ongoing work. We're running out of time, which is ridiculous, isn't it? I'm just scratching the surface here, but I'm wondering about you as a clinician as well. You've obviously come from being already an extremely competent and knowledgeable clinician. Have you noticed changes in yourself as you work in your clinic as well?
I think so. Doing that project prompted me to seek mentoring. I think it made me realise just how important it was to be scrupulous with ourselves and how we're delivering care, to really reflect on what it is that you're doing and put it under the microscope a little bit more. So that's been wonderful for me. I've been doing some coaching with Laura Rathbone, who I know you've had on here before, and that's really helped my practice enormously. I think the whole experience has just made me a lot more empathetic as well to people's experiences in compensable care. The idea that, you know, sometimes it's really dehumanizing and upsetting, I think that's a good thing. I think just talking about it with other people as well, that people in compensable care do miss out. And that they can do with our help.
I'm going to stick it out there, but imagine if we had the ability to completely change the system of claimant and commensable care, you wanted to design it for the best of clinician and best of the person who's there suffering, and what might that look like in 1,000 years time?
Yeah. Oh man, that's the magic wand question, isn't it, Tim? I think it would be really early access to high quality care. And I think that's, it's not always easy. You know, there's some emerging evidence that clinicians refusing to treat is a really big problem. And I think services tend to fill the economic structures that are put in place. So, you know, if you're not paying very much for these types of services, then, you tend to get lower quality services. So I think if we could pay people better to be in that space, we pay clinicians, experienced clinicians, to be in that space and to be rewarded properly, to be able to access that care nice and early and continuously, so there's not administrative cause delays to care, and to make the process as smooth as possible for claimants. Just if we did those really simple things so that they're not having to fight, so that they're not having to sell the fact that they've got pain when they pick up the phone, so that we just automatically believe them. I think those things would be a good start.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds great. So can I do my best to summarise a little bit? So first of all, we talked about your PhD looking at early interventions to prevent persistence from injury, and looking at the stress of engaging with claims and how it's an incredibly stressful, distressing process, and interestingly that clinicians are also quite distressed and frustrated by it as well. That's one particular area that you really found interesting was the frustration overlap between the two and the feeling that no one really cared. I mean, surely we can do better immediately there, can't we? Doesn't need to be a magic wand for that one, I don't think. and that there was asking people who'd gone through the process what they thought could be done. They'd like to be able to understand the claims process. They felt quite overwhelmed by it. Had a desire, which I found quite interesting, for self-management of pain. So that would be wonderful, wouldn't it, that someone's coming and saying, okay, what can I do to help myself? And also the need for some support, some social support as well. And you designed an intervention that included elements of that at least we're being a little bit careful, aren't we, about what you took from it, but it looks like people really benefited from getting knowledge about the process and also some individually tailored knowledge about what they can do and what was going on for them. And then, wow, so much actually, wasn't there? And then you talked about the interesting sort of findings of some of the clinicians working in that space and how some people really thrived. That's what I got from it, of realising that actually they didn't have the skills and they needed to go away and learn and explore and build and starting to find that they were quite comfortable in complexity, uncertainty, complexity, and felt like I've the ninja. I love this idea of the feel of ninja, of having mastery or a sense of mastery and a sense of fulfillment doing that work as well. Is that a fair summary of what we've talked about?
I think you've done a wonderful job, Tim.
I'm trying. Oh, it's been such a great chat. Thank you so much. I feel like there's so much relevance actually from, and I'm a bit careful to share specifics, but I can hear two people very specifically going through quite distressful times that I'm involved in with their care. And oh, if we could just make that easier. If we could even just lower some of the distress, you called it, didn't you? And I think that feeds in the suffering that goes with you know, experiencing ongoing pain that can be incredibly disabling. So if we could just take some what sound like relatively simple steps, or we can just tweak the system slightly, then we could minimize the risk of that happening. That sounds brilliant.
Yeah.
Alison, thank you so much for that, and look out for your work in the future. As soon as we see it coming out, then we'll make sure that we give you a big shout out. If you're listening to this podcast and you've enjoyed it, well, first of all, thanks very much for listening in, and like it and share it and tell everybody about it. And if you want to do what some of the clinicians have obviously done, where they're building their knowledge of pain, you can do that through LePub. We have a premium membership where for £15 a month you can listen to people like Alison teach us about being better clinicians and learn from the researchers. And I'm totally biased, but I think it's amazing. So come on board. Alison, awesome.
Tim, thanks so much for having me.